Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Eliza Skinner, and alongside the BBC's athletics commentator Ed Harry and Paralympian Scout Bassett, this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service, a show about Olympians and Paralympians who've gone faster, higher, stronger, which honestly sounds exhausting to me, which is probably why I still don't have an Olympic medal. There's always next year, though, or 4 years from now. Whatever.
Today, I have perhaps the most important question to ask you two that anyone has ever asked. What do you like better, summer or winter?
Summer. I love summer. I now live in a part of the UK where it rains all the time.
Oh, is it the UK?
Yeah, well, honestly, I've lived in Manchester for 10 years and it rains all the time. But when it's summer, it actually doesn't rain for a bit. And I love sunshine. I love going to the beach. And I know people like the changing of the color of the leaves and frosty mornings and all that. But if I could just have summer all the time, not scorching hot summer, just nice summer, that'd do me.
I'm with Ed. Ugh. Summer is my favorite season. I love water. I love going to the beach. But every now and then, I like the winter, but only for like a weekend or a week, right? Go to the mountains, you know, go to the ski hills, and that's all nice. And I think it's beautiful. But after about a week, I'm like, all right, I don't like being cold. I don't like having to wear all these layers, put all this stuff gear on.
You're both sportos. You've both answered like sportos who like to be outside and move around and not be trapped by weather. I, on the other hand, detest all of those things. I would much rather, because when you're cold, you get to be cozy. Mm-hmm. You get to go get warm someplace. And that, I find that much, much better than being sweaty. I don't like being sweaty. I don't like being overly hot. Ugh. I can't stand it.
So it's more of a condition for you.
Okay. Like, I have a condition.
You don't like to sweat. Okay. I got you.
I'm a bit worried as well that if me and Scout have our way, there will be no winter sports. We have to be quite careful here.
It's never made sense to me that the Summer Olympics seem so much more popular than the Winter Olympics. It's cool. They're doing cool stuff. They're still shushing around in spandex.
You're flinging yourself down a mountain in tons of different ways.
Winter sports are all snow-based or ice-based. Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
There's not just like running, but it's cold out.
Running would like to be part of the winters, I think, with cross country, but that hasn't happened yet. But I think there's a little bit of a movement that cross country runners think it would be quite a good place to place cross country within the Winter Olympic framework. But hasn't happened yet, but I think people would like it to, or some people would certainly.
Mm. I'd like to see more Paralympic sports in the winter. It's pretty sad in terms of limited sports and opportunities, especially for women at the Winter Games. For instance, there's no women's sled hockey. Even up until recently, a lot of the events in the downhill sports like snowboarding, and they didn't have a lot of women in some of those events or categories.
Well, you know how you could see one more woman para athlete competing in winter sports? Scout.
How?
You could do it.
Don't like the cold.
All right. Yes, you've said you don't like the cold. Right. Best get on with it. Ed, who is joining us on the podium?
Our guest today is a speed skating star who won team gold for Canada at his home Winter Olympics. 4 years later, he'd failed to qualify for the 1,000 metres in Sochi, but a teammate gave up his place in the event to give our guest a shot at making the Olympic podium once again, which he did. After winning 4 Olympic medals across 3 editions of the Games, a serious road accident and then a stroke could have been career-ending. Instead, Denny Morrison made it to his 4th Olympics in 2018. Denny, welcome to On the Podium.
Thanks for having me on, guys. and gals.
We're so glad to have you here. And we actually have some photos from your history that we're going to use to kind of guide our discussion. So let's take a look at this first photo.
So this is the Sochi Winter Olympic Games. This is after the 1,000 meters. It's all three medalists. You're there on the left of shot with your silver medal and your Canada tracksuit holding aloft the bouquet with the two Dutch athletes who got gold and bronze. We're starting with the silver, Denny, because you weren't going to be in this event. Tell us what happened at Canada's Olympic trials, and then tell us how you ended up even making the start line in Sochi for this.
I guess to add some context, I was ranked, I think, in the top five in the world in the 1,000 meters that season. And going into the Canadian Olympic trials, I sort of clipped my own skate around the back of my other ankle and fell, sliding me across the finish line in fourth place. And so not qualifying for that distance for the 1,000 meters. That was that. I still had to qualify for the Olympics through an individual event. So 2 days after I fell in the 1,000, I qualified in the 1,500 meters. Long story short, to jump to the highlight. And then at the Olympics, my teammate Gil Junio, who placed third in the Canadian team qualifying, and 2 days before the event, he decided that I had a better shot to win a medal for Canada in the 1,000 meters. And a very generous move by Gilmore, very much teamwork-centric move by Gilmore. He decided to give me his spot in 1,000 meters since I was the official alternate skater for the 1,000 meters. So he could just pull out of the event, make that official with the organizing committee, and then boom, I was in. And 2 days later, when I skated my 1,000 meters, I won a silver medal by 0.04 of a second away from gold. So I was, you know, literally this far from gold. And, you know, it's hard not to think about how much better that story could have been had I won gold.
But he still gets to brag to all of his friends that he was smart enough to make this move that that won a silver. Gets to have some ownership of it.
Yeah. It was a very, very cool, very special moment. And again, some of that pressure was there, right? Because now it's like, geez, you know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't come out of that last corner of the 1,000 and worry about falling, because that's what happened at the Olympic at the trials. And it was like, I better not fall now, right?
Yeah, it's like you're skating around with this gift that he's given you.
Before you got on, Denny, I was saying and kind of tongue-in-cheek to the group here, that what happened between you and Gilmore was a very Canadian thing to do, because it's pretty unusual in the space of sport where you would see that kind of sportsmanship, teamwork, camaraderie come together. But I suppose maybe not so unfamiliar in Canadian culture, because you all are very kind and, you know, generous people.
Well, we hope so. it did resonate with a lot of Canadians because it's such a land of many cultures, and we celebrate that in Canada. And I mean, this was never something that guided me in Gilmore's friendship or anything, but he is Filipino and then I am a white Canadian. His parents were immigrants to the country in the previous generation. And so it became like this kind of iconic Canadian moment that, you know, a lot of different families could relate to, regardless of their background, right? And so I think it spoke to a lot of people and what Canada's all about and working together to achieve a bigger goal.
Oh, we got another photo.
There we go.
Oh, there you guys are.
This is you. This is the closing ceremony for the Sochi Winter Olympic Games. And this is you, baseball cap on. Your medals are around your neck, but it's not the only thing you've got around your neck, because your friend Gilmore is sitting on your shoulders.
That's right. Yeah. He was the real prize, I think, at these games. And I mean, there's a bunch of other random context I can add to this. First of all, you see beside us, that's my other teammate, Will, who has a figure skater, Caitlin Osmond, on his shoulders. And so they were getting ready to walk out into the closing ceremonies like that. And that's why I was like, well, I don't need a figure skater on my shoulders. I got Gilmore right here. And so we popped him up. And again, the other part of the context of that is that after he gave me his spot and I won the medal, then I started... Twitter was the big thing at the time. So I was tweeting out how for Canada, Gilmore should be the flag bearer. As the flag bearer is usually someone who is super successful at the Olympics, like usually won medals and like sort of instills those Canadian values. And I thought it would be pretty special to have someone carry the flag for Canada who's done what we've talked about, like something for Canadians that isn't necessarily just the podium finish, right? Unfortunately, he never got it. So I thought I'd elevate him up a little bit, bring some attention to him. And maybe it speaks to how good of friends we are as well, because that's not something a lot of guys do at the closing ceremonies.
For every athlete, there's a moment, it could be an event, it could be a record achievement where you recognize, okay, I'm good, or I'm elite. When did you realize, like, gosh, I'm really good at this, and this is something I could do professionally?
For me, that moment was probably in grade 5. So I was 10 years old. You know, I had won Canadian championships for my age class here and there. But then went up to North Americans, and I won that too. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm pretty good at this. If I can beat everyone in Canada and in USA, like, I must be one of the best for my age. And if I can just keep staying the best for my age and keep getting older, then I'll be the best possibly in the world. Who knows, right? And so I kind of started believing that. So I came back from that North American championships and told my, with my gold medal, right? I told my classmates and my teachers and whoever that I want to compete in the Olympics one day. Again, going with my brother helping me set those shorter term goals all along the way, this became like a long term goal from when I was 10 years old.
When did you first beat your elder brother? Where did that happen, and how did that go down with him?
So after graduating, I moved to Calgary to skate on the national team. I wanted to, you know, win Olympic gold in the athlete side of things. But then my brother 2 years earlier moved to Calgary, same idea, but also to go to school, because University of Calgary campus is like attached to the Olympic Oval where the national team for Canada trains. And so I moved for school and I wanted to become a doctor, and for speed skating and I wanted to become an Olympic champion, right? Turns out neither of those things were going perfectly well. I was doing kind of mediocre at both. And so I was in 2003, 2004, I took a few less classes. And then 2005, I took a few less classes, and my speed skating results started ramping up really quickly as I tapered off the other things. And wasn't just that it let me focus on training more, but like the recovery and the getting the physiotherapy and the massage therapy and, you know, the sleep and the food and the timing of all these things plays into your results as an athlete. Long story short, I basically dropped out of school, out of university. I said I'd always come back and finish those courses that I didn't finish yet. But it was basically in that process, I didn't just beat my brother, but I beat everyone in the world that year. Basically, like 2006, I think I tied my brother's junior Canadian record the year before. And then the next year I broke the Canadian record and I skated the like third or fourth fastest 1500 meter time ever. At the time I told all my teammates and stuff, I like basically got frustrated. I was like, why are you even in school? If you want to succeed in speed skating, you have to focus just on speed skating. And that became a whole theme for me in my career. I just figure if you're going to do something, why not do it well, right? Everyone wants to be a perfectionist, but there's like backlash. You don't want to say you're a perfectionist, but it's like, I think there's nothing wrong with attempting to do something really well.
Because the gold medal was at home in Canada, wasn't it? 2010, Vancouver had the Winter Olympic Games.
I think we have a photo of you in Vancouver at the Olympics with your gold medal.
This photo actually, because my individual races, my 1,000, 1,500 at these Olympics. And so I wanted to win 3 gold medals at those Olympics and did terribly in my first 2 races. And I feel like we'd be remiss in pumping me up and my success and calling me a perfectionist. But if I didn't say that, like the look on my face here is one of sort of, I finally reached satisfaction. I got my gold medal, but I was kind of crushed at this point. And following those Olympics, I wanted to like leave speed skating and kind of escape the world that I knew forever. Cause I was actually like so disappointed and so crushed about my individual races at those Olympics, which is such a weird thing, right? Here I am, gold medal around my neck. The whole story I've told you already is like, that was my long-term goal from when I was 10 years old. And I think it's fair to say that I was like, went into a very serious depression at the time, you know, the mental turmoil and the psychological side of it was starting to catch up with me. And I was like, what am I doing with my life? I should go to school. I feel like I somehow was so focused on the medals that I didn't win that it took away from what was a really awesome and positive reality at the time.
So it was that perfectionism, that sounds like you don't have a perfect record.
Yeah. And that really brought me down, right? Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you bring up a very relatable point, certainly for me as an athlete. One of the worst feelings you can have as an athlete is the feeling of knowing that you perhaps didn't rise to the occasion, or you didn't meet your own expectations, much less anybody else's expectations. And that's a feeling that's hard to move past and to get through. So I'm just curious, how did you move past that or work through that?
That's a really good question. I think as much as I'd love to share some really inspirational story about how I moved through it, I don't think that I moved through it in a healthy way whatsoever.
We want the real. Yeah. We want the raw. It's all good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I never did any drugs for what that's worth, but I became a pretty heavy drinker for that whole summer and stuff, and probably into the next season, which is part why I got never got the results I wanted, right? Never took training seriously and was kind of spiraling down to this, very not Olympic gold medalist, pursuit of excellence type of lifestyle, I guess. Yeah. And then, I mean, there's a few moments with my coaches and my sports psychologist, because I got a new coach. Yeah. I just remember they had me do this survey sort of, and basically there was one thing on it. It was sort of, you're saying, how do you feel about when you read these sentences or something? And then there was one, I feel like I missed out in the most important moment in time and will never have that opportunity again. I circled it like 20 times. So it kind of stuck out on the thing. And then they came back and talked to me about that. And I kind of broke down at the time when I was trying to explain how that made me feel. But yeah. I don't know. I don't know the exact thing, but that's something that stands out to me, is it shifted it. And then our coaches came up with this philosophy called the Team Diamonds philosophy. So in order to become a diamond, it has to be mined from the earth. And diamonds in their mined form they're ugly, and they're created under some of the most high pressure situations. And then they have to be mined. And after they're mined, you have to clean them, shake them out, get rid of the debris, cut them, polish them, and hone these diamonds down to the perfect sparkling diamond that you get in the Olympic venue or in the display case. And so we focused, that was sort of our philosophy, and how we had to work as teams because diamonds are formed in clusters. And so this is, again, this whole philosophy is something that I bought into pretty quick, and I think our teammates bought into. And this is something, again, Gilmore was a bit part of this team, right? And so when I think it came to the Olympics, the whole Gilmore Denny story and the giving up of the spot boils back down to Team Diamonds. Every time you quit, it put a blemish in your diamond. It would never quite be the same diamond as it could have been when you have it on display at the Olympics. And so we had this no excuses, no quitting mentality, which was kind of old school, but it was pretty neat.
Not to harp on the perfectionism, but it sounds like a great way to tackle perfectionism by saying, like, if you just stay in, just don't quit,
right?
That will keep improving this diamond that we're building together, or these diamonds.
Exactly. Yeah. And keep working towards that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And today's guest is Canadian speed skater Denny Morrison.
Let's see, I think we have some other pictures. What else do we have?
This is a picture of a motorcycle parked up, looking down a long open road. And I guess this alludes to another chapter. You told us about what happened after Vancouver. You've told us about everything that happened on the road to Sochi. And Sochi was your third Winter Olympic Games. Then two things happen, and let's take them one at a time. In May of 2015, you had a really serious road accident involving you on your bike. What happened?
Yeah, this picture beside my motorcycle in the mountains says Destroyer of Worlds, but damn, I really did love this bike. And then what happened in the crash? The sun was still out. It was like whatever, 5 p.m. Basically, I was approaching an intersection from this side, then a car was approaching this side, and then turned left. And then I went flipping off my bike, and my bike went under the car. I landed on my chin and my chest, like face down on the asphalt. I like saw sky. Can you imagine? I'm flipping, and then I am like, oh, there's headlights. And I was like, oh no, not the headlights. And then I just like asphalt, asphalt, asphalt. And it was just like, boom. And that's where it all went black for me. And I just remember my helmet like sliding up on my face. I had a full face on, luckily. I kind of hurt my jaw after, and I had a neck brace on my motorcycle jacket. And I think that if I didn't, my head might have come right off for all I know. So that caused a whole bunch of injuries. I think so. My femur was broken. You know, one of the bigger ones as a speed skater, you're like, it's gonna be hard to speed skate with a broken femur. And with that, my right kneecap was broken. And then with that, the ACL behind the kneecap was like torn off. One of my kidneys was, it's still to this day, damaged, I think. I only know this because I'm in med school now, and I'm like, know my glomerular filtration rates and stuff. And I'm like, oh, that is off, isn't it? Like, so anyways, I had kidney damage. I had my liver was damaged. Like, it's all bleeding internally, essentially. But I broke this ulna in the motorcycle crash, and I had a cut on my quads because the teardrop muscle on your knee, in front of your knee, is called the vastus medialis oblique. The way my knee hit, it basically like sheared that muscle kind of off. Probably that was one of the bigger injuries that like slowed down my recovery a lot.
I just wish that we could show on the radio what our faces look like listening to this, because we just keep...
Wow.
At any point, did anyone say to you, or did you say to yourself, I'm not going to be able to speed skate again, not after that?
I've sensed that from people, but even in the hospital bed, I was sort of like, well, this is a whole new challenge on the road to Korea, isn't it? And now I'm in the hands of the support staff. They're going to help me recover this. They're going to help give me the program, adjust the program. I just need to listen to the experts. Control the controllables is another thing in speed skating we talk a lot about, because there's so many things out of your control that... And so the more things I can put in the control of the massage therapist, the coach, the physiologist for the team and stuff, the more that I let them take care of that and tell me what to do. And as long as I do those things, then... I just need to lay in this hospital bed. Like, this is easy. I can't control my recovery now. I just have to wait and let the medical staff do it. And when I can recover, I'll recover. And I'll take those steps as they come.
And this is the next one coming over the hill. Not quite a year later, you were cycling on the Arizona Trail and you had a stroke. So about 11 months on from the motorcycle crash, which you were getting better from, then that happens to you. And it was you and your girlfriend, wasn't it? You and Josie, who's now your wife, cycling. And she saw something was wrong, didn't she? Just tell us what she saw. And I guess after that, things had to move pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing becomes a love story when I include Josie in it, because she was at the hospital bed after my motorcycle crash. I really liked Josie. And I think we had kind of been seeing each other a little bit, but with the narcotics that were on board after the motorcycle crash, because visiting hours were over or whatever. And so I told the nurses that the nurses had said only family is allowed in. I said, oh, that's my fiance. You have to let her in.
And she was not aware of that.
She wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
Good one.
So they kept letting her in all the time. And I was in the hospital for 7 days. And near the end, when I was trying to get discharged, my brother's wedding was in 9 days after the motorcycle crash. And so as the occupational therapist and people are coming to like tell me to make sure that I'm good on stairs, and they're asking me, because I'm still like pretty out of it, they're asking Josie like, oh, does he have stairs in his house? She's never been to my house. And they're like, oh, you're his fiance though, right? And she's like, no, we're not even dating.
Glad it all worked out in the end.
So that was in May, the motorcycle crash. By August, we were officially dating.
Very sweet.
So I decided I need to do a ton more aerobic exercise to get my training back up to level. So why not in April, I'm going to go do the Arizona Trail. And Josie decided she'd like to come with me. It's a bike packing trip. We did it on mountain bikes. You have to take your tents and your sleeping bags and your food and your tools and your equipment all with you. It's 800-mile trail that took us 20 days. And you're in like some of the most remote parts of Arizona deserts. You have to hike down the Grand Canyon and back up the other side. So, you know, how this stroke occurred almost anywhere else on that trail, it could have been, yeah, like even right in this photo, it's like we're in a burnt out forest. And, you know, is Josie going to drag me out on her bike to get to a hospital? Like, it would have been really serious. And I mean, every stroke is serious, but ultimately we did finish the Arizona Trail. We got right to the end. And the next morning is when I was feeling kind of weird. I noticed I couldn't brush my teeth with my right hand, and toothpaste was like coming out of my mouth, but you're just kind of like, oh man, I'm really groggy this morning. I don't know. Wasn't that hungry, ate breakfast. We drove from St. George to Salt Lake City, which is like 3 hours. And if you can't tell, I'm an extrovert. I'm usually very talkative. But I just like fell asleep in the back seat, which is not me. And then we stopped for gas in Salt Lake City. And I was like, okay, I'm paying for the gas. I get out and I like struggle to get out of the car. And as I'm walking from the car to the gas pump, like 3 steps, my saddle like is flying off. Because essentially, in hindsight, I was like dragging my foot, kicking it forward kind of thing. I had like these thong sandals on, got the car filled up, and then we get going again. And Josie's noticing as I'm eating food, it's just like I'm drooling it out of my mouth. And she like knows how to recognize the signs of stroke. She's like, Denny, this is really serious. Something's going on. But it wasn't until she took my phone, texted our the team lead. He's a physiotherapist on our support team. And she's like, Denny's drooling. He's dragging his foot. He's slurring his speech. And he texts back, 911, get to the hospital right away. And I was like, okay, let's go to the hospital. Like, but there's some other things I could pantomime. My glasses, I was literally like Peter Griffin on Family Guy. My glasses were like on my face sideways. I was trying to put my jacket on, and I couldn't get my left arm up into my jacket. So I was like a dog chasing its tail, trying to put my jacket on. It was like ridiculous. And I laughed at myself. And when I laughed at myself, it sounded really funny. Like it sounded really stupid. Like it sounded like I was making fun of myself, laughing at myself. When that happened, I was like, let's get to the hospital. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. Like through all of that, you were like, I'm fine. I'm fine. This is okay.
Yeah. Those last three things happened as we were walking to the car to go to the hospital again. But yeah. But I still like, as they wheelchaired me inside, I was like, I feel pretty fine. Like, I was like, I don't know. Like, I hardly know what a stroke is. You know, I'm like, yeah, I'm just tired. I want to go home. Can we just drive? Like, I don't want the delays. And, you know, I wasn't cognitively there. The only thing more serious than this is like an arterial bleed coming in. That's like someone spurting blood. It's like, so they literally wheel me in. I don't even wait in the waiting room. They wheel me straight to an MRI. Get that scan done. They're like, yeah, you had a stroke. Look at all this. And they transport me to another hospital for emergency surgery to fix the stent. And so that's why I belabored the point about how I landed in my motorcycle crash, is because the way that I like landed my chin and chest, they think that some trauma happened to the carotid artery, sort of at the base of the skull here.
So I had like a clot or something.
Yeah. And so I had a little pseudo aneurysm, this is an artery. I had like a little balloon off the side of it. And that was letting little clots go. And then a bigger one flew off in this case and caused like the full on stroke. But prior to it, I'd actually over the course of between the motorcycle crash and the stroke itself, including a few times on the Arizona Trail, I had like transient ischemic attacks because a little pieces of clot were coming up and my vision was affected in my left eye and stuff. And I had gone to get that checked out, and they said it was a migraine aura and that it wasn't a problem. And I would just have a nap for like 30 minutes, wake up. Okay, it seems to be gone. But, you know, in hindsight, it was very big warning signs for something more serious that could come. It was all very scary. I guess just to include that story. So, I mean, I made it to the Olympics. And that was, for me, that was like, in some ways, it was a bigger victory than going to my first Olympics. You know what I mean? It was, you know, what can we overcome in the face of all odds to get back to the Olympics, and how hard can I work? And then you retire. I retired from speed skating in 2020. I restarted my schooling career after a quick 15-year break. The first two courses I took that summer were women's studies, which I took with Josie because she was also back in school as she's become a nurse, which she is now. That's the other thing I've hanging on my wall. I got my medals and then I got my degrees. So I got Bachelor of Science in Psychology with distinction and a Bachelor of Science Honors in Anthropology, which just means I did some research and stuff. So
you've spoken all through your sporting life about having a team around you, not just your teammates, but psychologists, dietitian and physio and all these other things. How important has it been for you and Josie to go back into academic life together? Because suddenly when you're a student again, you haven't got a whole support staff trying to make you the best student you can be, have you? It's just you, or it's just you and Josie in this case.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was another scary thing, right? So it was one thing that I had had this stroke. I'd had 15 years off of university, but I'd lost, you know, the teammates to study with and maybe the tutors or the support staff to help me study or whatever, right? For speed skating. Yeah. So having Josie, she was honestly one of the biggest encouragements for me to go back and just take some courses with me this summer and just see how it goes. Otherwise, what are we doing, right? And so she gave me that boost I needed just to sort of believe in myself initially to get back into school. And yeah, and I don't know who wrote this. It's in a book I read at the time. I was reading tons of books back then. And again, after the stroke, recovering from the stroke, I like had really bad slurred words and stuff. So I would read a lot out loud to Josie and I'd read the books and I must've read, I don't know, 5,000 pages out loud to Josie just to like work on enunciation and stuff. Anyway, sorry, that's an aside. What were we talking about? This is a problem with strokes. This is a problem with strokes. I tangent a lot.
That's very interesting.
Obviously experiencing a stroke is very serious and many times the recovery process is very intensive. So going from the stroke and the road to 2018 to the Olympics. Can you talk a little bit about more of how that process went in terms of your recovery, and what was that like to get to the games, considering that you had had something that was very serious that not only affects your physical ability, but you know, other aspects of what you need to compete?
Yeah, the mental ability, right? And yeah, like the motorcycle crash was like purely physical injuries. And then the stroke was, you know, I was not in physical pain whatsoever. But for me, and you know, every stroke is different. The symptoms of every stroke are a little different depending on where the brain is affected and stuff. But it was just frustrating to like not be able to express why I felt the way I felt sometimes. Depression and stroke go together. Like, I think it's like a 60% or more, 60-80%. My neurologist, I specifically remember him saying, well, you're a very motivated patient, so that's good to see. You'll fare well. It wasn't until years later in one of my fourth year psychology courses that I took just before I got into med school. It was a course on motivation and emotion and what motivation looks like, and how it's actually hard to define motivation. And, you know, motivation is like a huge predictor of outcomes though, right? Again, I just take everything I learned in speed skating and put it on the recovery, right? And so I was motivated to go to the 2018 Olympics, but that's what made me motivated to improve from my stroke setback, and what made me motivated to improve the motorcycle thing. So the stroke was like very different from the motorcycle crash, but also very just another thing that I believed that I could come up with, that I could overcome, right?
How did the recovery process though affect the training leading up to those games? Were there days you just simply couldn't train?
Basically, I guess more of a physical way because of that, I wasn't allowed to raise my heart rate really at all for 2 months. And then after 2 months, I could increase it by 5 beats per week. I was supposed to keep it under 100 for 2 months. And then it was 120 because I was like, okay, I can ride my bike at 120. And so I biked from Calgary to Edmonton to watch the Canadian track and field championships, which is, it's a 300 kilometer bike ride. So I did it in 2 days, you know, but like you can ride a bike at, you know, under 120 heart rate. It's like, you just have to ride easy. And so I just let it take my time. And I think that's an interesting crossover between like the physical rehabilitation, because I wanted to keep training my aerobic system, but also like being alone on a bicycle for what amounted to 12 or 13 hours of cycling from Calgary to Edmonton over 2 days. It was just like a mental out in nature. You get lots of time to think. And I think that's half the reason I did that bike ride too. So, but it was scary though, right? When you go from 120, which is fine, 125, 130, 35. Now I'm like on my aerobic threshold kind of thing. And 140, 145, 150, now I'm anaerobic. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to take my heart rate there today. That's like working pretty hard for me. And it's like, will I have a stroke and die? You know, those fears is one thing if I'm on a stationary bike doing it, but then when I'm speed skating, surpassing those benchmarks, it's pretty scary. And speed skating also, because my whole left side of my body was affected, so I had a slight foot drag. So in speed skating, you're on a 1 millimeter blade going around a turn at like a 30 or 40 degree angle, landing on that blade just perfectly. And if you don't land on it just perfectly, then like what happened at my Olympic trials in 2014, you can snag a blade on the other foot or whatever, and the race is over. You're out. It's just hard to, without context, it's hard for me to quantify for you guys how much fear there was in this process. Like, will I just pass out at some point and just fall, or, you know, will I fall and hurt myself? And again, a little bit of random context story here. I was at a barbecue. It's like 3 months after, so I'm like feeling fairly recovered. I can walk pretty good and I can speak pretty good. And I'm holding whatever, a red Solo cup. And I'm just talking to the person. I'm not paying attention to it. And the cup just like fell out of my hand because it's like just the strength isn't there. If I'm not paying attention to it, then it's not there, right? And then you just spill your drink everywhere and it's embarrassing and it's, you know, it's stupid. So to this day, I hold cups like this now.
So they don't drop. Just in case.
Yeah, just in case. Yeah. Just tuck the finger, the pinky under the cup. But the perpetuity of those little things happening and just kind of building up and snowballing, you know, lead to some of that mental dissonance where you're like, I can't, I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm not going to be able to get through this. And you have those messages repeating through your head 1,000 times a day for years. It adds up and it wears on a person for sure. And then you're going to go try to skate on a 1 millimeter blade going 60 kilometers an hour around a frozen ice track, you know, and it just park those thoughts for a bit, right? And just like, so it's challenging, but it's different than just like, my knee hurts, so I can't skate until, the knee pain went away, now I can skate fine, right? It's more like this is something that's always there and it's challenging in a whole different way. I feel like you ask questions and I just tangent off and then we're like over here in Narnia.
Well, no, it's because we're listening too, because it's fascinating, honestly.
It's okay. I'm like, do I go back to that question? Because what he said was really, really interesting. So I feel like that's better than what I asked. But I asked, like, how did it feel when you did finally qualify for the Olympics after having gone through all of that, had and carried all that doubt?
Yeah. I don't know. I wanted to just celebrate making it. It was different for me for sure than the other Olympics, where I was like, hey, qualification's done with. I'm moving on to the Olympic medals now, right? In the medal round. But yeah, the 2018 Olympics were a lot different. I didn't want it as much as I wanted to just get, you know, make it, I guess. But I felt like I had to want it once I made it.
I mean, you did both, so
yeah.
End of the story. It worked out.
That was a sweet time.
I know we haven't got you for much longer. I just wanted to ask you, you've mentioned going back to your medical studies. What's the end game in terms of, I guess, the next part of your career and also your life? What area of medicine do you want to end up in?
So I've put a lot of thought into this, and I couldn't have told you this either a year ago because I didn't know what physiatry was, even though I worked with a lot of physiatrists. A physiatrist is basically a doctor of physiotherapy. So they do like MSK stuff like a physiotherapist would, but they also work with like people who have spinal issues like in a wheelchair bound, or if you've had a stroke and you have neurological issues like I've had. So I think it'd be kind of cool given my whole life story and experience. And again, the volunteering I've done with Heart and Stroke has given me the opportunity to meet a ton of other stroke survivors. And I think it has created something special where because I've had a stroke, I can bridge that gap to the patient and allow them to sort of share their own experience with me. When I met them during the Heart and Stroke events, it was really amazing for me. It was like part of what inspired me to get back to the Olympics was knowing that here's someone with a stroke different than mine, affects their speech more than mine, affects their ability to walk more than mine, but they're fighting for the ability to paint again, right? Because that's their passion. And they're fighting for their ability to, you know, talk to their grandkids again or whatever it is. And so to see other stroke survivors going through, in some cases, much different experiences than I had, inspired me to, you know, keep pursuing my dream and my passion in speed skating and to go for those 2018 Olympics.
I just want to say thank you for giving us so much time. It's been fascinating speaking to you, and we can't wait to see what you do next.
Awesome. Great talking to you guys. Thank you very much.
I'm serious. Not only do I want to see the movie, I feel like there's a whole series of movies, like a trilogy maybe, about Denny. This is, what a guy. What a bunch of stories.
And I love the way that things get woven in. So we're talking about a motorcycle crash and then a stroke when biking the Arizona Trail. And Denny says, well, actually, this is a love story. And I told the nurses she was my fiance and told Josie that I loved her. And then she was the one that spotted that I needed to go to hospital because I was suffering a stroke. And then we both qualified for the next Olympic Games. That's the second film, isn't it? Because the first film is what Gilmore did that enabled him to do what he did.
And then probably a medical drama. We're going to have to see how the next few years.
He's going to be like a doctor in Grey's Anatomy or something.
Yeah.
The only winning one gold medal at your home Olympics when you thought you could and should have done so much more and almost thinking, should I walk away from the sport because I feel empty and I'm suffering depression. And you know, what is that maybe the teaser at the end of the credits in the first film? I don't know where you put all of these things, but it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
But it's definitely sellable.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
If you don't see us here next week, it's because we've just worked out a treatment. And off we go. But wow.
I loved his Team Diamond concept, that model could apply to any industry. It was a great analogy, and I loved how their team rallied around that. And I definitely was taking notes because I feel like that's something I could take with me going forward.
I definitely feel like I could take that with me personally. And it's also like a more clear version of what you try to do in a writer's room. The first ideas that everybody pitches, they don't need to be perfect and polished and ready to go into a ring or a show. But you know that the pressure you're all putting on it will get it there. So you're right, all kinds of industries.
Well, I kind of get that you get a gold medal and it's on the podium is what we're doing. You get a gold medal because gold is precious and it's rare and it's hard to find. But when you do find it, you know what it is because it doesn't interact with anything else. It's just there in the ground waiting to be found. Whereas the diamond analogy almost made me think, well, they should hang diamonds around your neck when you win these events, because I'm almost thinking the diamond analogy works better than the gold medal does.
I can tell you it's probably would be worth a lot more than the gold medal.
These are getting to be very expensive competitions.
Because those are like plated. Those are like gold plated. They're not even like, or gold vermeil. They're not even full gold.
So let's just add the diamonds onto that and just really, really ornate, blinged out.
I mean, it might make things prohibitively expensive to host any major sporting event ever again, but
dazzling.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
Basketball was kind of like my outlet. Find what makes you feel whole and you feel complete, and you continue to realize, like, this is why I'm here. And it's not always easy, and it's not going to be like the end all be all, but it's going to make you continue to realize how much strength that you have and the fight you have to kind of keep going.
Basketball star and double gold medalist Breonna Stewart on why she speaks up for survivors of child abuse. Next time on The Podium.
I could feel stigma all around me.
I nearly died 3-4 times.
I had this secret.
This is Lives Less Ordinary, a podcast dedicated to remarkable personal stories.
I started having a strength in me.
Each week, we hear tales of the unexpected.
Walk in the shoes of some extraordinary people.
It's something quite wonderful.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.